Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It is Tuesday, April 8th. This morning, we take a closer look at federal laws that fund reproductive health services, including affordable contraception. What local programs saw their funding abruptly cut off on April 1st? No fooling. We hear about concerns from a local attorney who fought long and hard to improve services for special needs children in our public schools. All this as the Trump administration takes steps to eliminate the U.S. Department of Education. And we hear from a photographer from Maui who's just released a film about the first return of whales after the fires, what we can learn about whales, their tenacity and resilience. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. On April 1st, federal funds for programs that provide reproductive health services were abruptly halted. It's known in some circles as Title 10, a federal act established in 1970 that provides affordable birth control for needy families, as well as preventative health care services. Here with more on this is HPR's Ashley Mizzou. Good morning.
Good morning. Yeah, so the state receives about $2.1 million in federal Title 10 funding. That goes to clinics to support things like health care services, birth control, STI testing, and treatment, cancer screenings. And then that $2.1 million is distributed to 13 different health centers kind of across the state.
And that STI, that sexually transmitted diseases.
Okay. Yeah. So that $2.1 million has been withheld. Seven other states have had the same thing happen to them. Under the first Trump administration, he put what is commonly referred to as a gag order on providers, which basically meant that you couldn't receive Title 10 funding if you did any type of referrals for abortion services or offered abortion services. And that went into effect in 2019 and effectively slashed all of the state's Title 10 funding at that time. It was eventually reinstated in 2022 under President Joe Biden's administration. But Amy Moy, co-CEO of Essential Access, who administers the Title 10 grant program in Hawaii, says this is different because the funding was abruptly cut off on March 31st for the funding period that was supposed to begin the very next day.
The big difference now is that there is uncertainty around the timing of the funds being withheld, when and how and if they may be released, and how immediate the impact could be. There was no time to prepare. There was no time to address any specific gaps that may be felt at the provider level and therefore could potentially impact patient access.
And so during the first Trump administration, basically all of these clinics and these grant administrators had kind of ample time to kind of see as the administration had like crafted that rule, that gag order, so they could kind of figure out how they can like figure out different ways to fund certain services. There was just more time to prepare, but this time it was an abrupt cutoff the day before the funding was supposed to start. And the reasoning given for withholding these funds is that the administration wanted to ensure that the grantees are complying with President Trump's executive orders, particularly those banning diversity, equity, and inclusion. Moy estimates that about 13,000 patients were served last year in Hawaii through Title 10 funding, but that number is likely well below the actual amount because they just recently implemented a data collection system.
So have you heard directly from these individual clinics?
Yeah, so it means kind of different things for different clinics since they all have different amounts of funding and are using them in different ways. I spoke with Chris Peel, the medical director at Hawaii Island Community Health Center, which received about $300,000 in Title 10 funding.
It supports things like salaries for OBGYNs, salaries for women's health staff that support the practice, equipment like ultrasound machines, long-acting contraception for patients who would otherwise not have access to it, and sexual health for children, for minors. This is going to disproportionately impact young women because we use a lot of this funding to test for infections and treat infections, provide contraception to teens, and just do confidential visits for teens who would otherwise not have access to sexual health.
And that need for confidential services is one that came up a lot, especially for teenagers who, you know, might need to be tested or treated for sexually transmitted diseases that wouldn't be comfortable or able to safely use their parents' insurance, as well as many other circumstances where family planning services are needed, but the patient either doesn't have insurance or cannot use the insurance that they have for confidentiality reasons. Some of the clinics are also the only health centers that offer this type of care in the area. That's the case for Waianae Coast Comprehensive Health Center. It was also receiving about $300,000 a year from Title X, and they've been receiving funding from Title X for most of the last 30 plus years, besides, you know, when the gag order went into effect during the first Trump administration. Pat McKenzie, their senior director of clinical initiatives and response, says because of the withholding of federal dollars, people who could once access the care for free will probably need to pay.
If these changes continue, we're not going to even be able to offer that. I mean, people are just going to have to come up with the cash and help. And so what will happen there is people won't come in for STD testing. People won't come in for early pregnancy testing. People won't be able to afford to come in and get birth control. You know, they talk about, oh, you can get birth control pills now at the pharmacy. You know, you don't even need a prescription, but there's still, you know, it can be anywhere from $50 to $70 a pack. That's not doable. That's just not doable.
And Planned Parenthood's Kahului Health Center received about $150,000 a year of Title X funding, and they said that they serve about 68% of their patients in Kahului through those funds.
And are there any plans to, you know, backfill those funds if, you know, everything dries up?
Yeah, so many of the providers are calling on the state legislature to fill that void. I did ask to speak with House Finance Chair Kyle Yamashita about this, but he declined an interview, but instead sent me an email saying that the legislature is taking a measured approach to respond cautiously rather than act impulsively, and that the money set aside to offset reductions in federal support may not be enough to cover all of the needs. And I think he was referring to the $200 million that the House put into the state's rainy day fund that's meant to kind of been stashed away to address some of these needs, particularly if in the case of Medicaid cuts. And so I think they're not sure yet as to what they can backfill and what the state, like the resources that the state has, and they haven't had time yet to really figure out what these cuts mean and what they can backfill at the legislature.
Right. And then there is the a plan to come into special session later this fall.
Yeah, lots help. Of talk about yeah. that. Yes. Probably will be a special session sometime. I think they were saying probably in August, but that hasn't been confirmed yet. They've just been talking about it.
All right. Well, thanks so much, Ashley.
Thank you.
We've been talking to HPR's Ashley Mizuo. Look for her stories on HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
Support for HPR comes from Hawaii Pacific University, dedicated to higher education for Hawaii students. Learn more about its Holomua commitment to high school seniors at hpu.edu/holomua.
This year marks 50 years since Republican President Gerald Ford signed into law an act that guaranteed free and appropriate public education to every child with a disability. That law became the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, or IDEA. In 1990, Congress added the Americans with Disabilities Act, including Title II, which George H.W. Bush signed into law. Next month marks 20 years since Hawaii got out from under a consent decree because it failed to live up to federal laws to provide education for special needs students. We reached out to the attorney who sued the Hawaii Departments of Education and Health, which led to 11 years of federal oversight on behalf of thousands of students with disabilities. Eric Seitz filed that legal challenge, which became known as the Felix case, because it was filed on behalf of Jennifer Felix, a Maui student with special needs. Seitz is worried about what will happen if the U.S. Department of Education is eliminated by the Trump administration. He says he's preparing to take the public school system to court once again. Here's Seitz.
First of all, when the Felix litigation was terminated, it was terminated based on a motion that says the state has substantially complied, whatever that meant. And we disputed that. There were lots of things in the consent decree that they had not complied with. Nevertheless, at the time that the Felix litigation ended, we had one of the best special education programs in the state of Hawaii. We were serving thousands and thousands more kids than when we started litigation. We had, I think, 90% of teachers who were certified to teach special education when we started with well under 40%. We were getting kids evaluated and getting services to them in record periods of time. And one of the most amazing things was every baby born in a hospital in the state of Hawaii was being evaluated before the baby left the hospital for developmental delays. that wasn't going on in any other state in the country. So, you know, we had accomplished an enormous amount in the Felix litigation. But as soon as the litigation and the court supervision went away, they began to remove funds and services began to terminate. And right away, anything that wasn't federally mandated was dismantled. We are now back in a position where there are many, many complaints by parents, by teachers. I get calls even from principals. I get calls from people who were formerly complex area specialists who were responsible for supervision of special ed services who are saying the state's just doing a horrific job. Horrible. I get probably 5 to 10 complaints a week, and they're very serious complaints about kids who were really failing and for whom the programs that were developed for them are obviously inadequate and the services are not being provided. And when parents try to dispute that, they get smashed by the attorney generals and the hearing officers who are now all in-house rather than independent as they used to be. And when teachers complain, they get put on administrative leave and they get fired because the DOE doesn't want to hear that they're not doing the job that they're required to do.
Yeah, I mean, this was 12 years of oversight. 20 years is a long time. So you basically made progress, but we've slid.
Yeah, and that's, you know, I mean, to a significant degree, that's kind of expected with state programs. I did a massive class action involving the prisons, overpopulation, lack of medical care, et cetera, in 1984. I think we had the consent decree. And again, you know, 20 years, 30 years later, things unwind, the priorities change, and the state reduces funding, so you have to go through it again. So, you know, it's not entirely unexpected, but what is of greater concern right now is that if you remove the federal apparatus that provides the money and supervises how that money is spent, basically the state personnel who are responsible for these programs are going to think that they can get away with a whole lot more. And the parents and the kids are going to suffer, as well as the teachers, many of whom are extremely dedicated to these children.
And it's not real clear, you know, how and when this is all going to happen. I mean, I know when we reached out to the school superintendent and the school board chair, this notion that the Department of Education was going to be dismantled, I know they said, well, it's not going to happen overnight. There are quite a few steps, if that's in fact the intent. But it sure does seem like it's happening fast.
Yeah, and, you know, I mean, unfortunately, if we were at a high level of delivering those services now, then we could afford to be a little flexible and sit back and wait to see what's going to happen and how those programs are going to be managed at the federal level. But unfortunately, we're doing a horrific job right now, and so it's only going to get worse. And, you know, if you don't deliver kids the services that they need, especially disabled kids, at critical stages in their lives developmentally, you can't recoup that. These kids are going to suffer for the rest of their lives. And their families are going through horrible times dealing with the challenges that they have. Coupled with that, in Hawaii, we don't have any mental health programs or services for kids. We don't have a children's mental health hospital or facility. We have temporary crisis facilities, but that's all we have. So we don't have any long-term, well-staffed, well-trained personnel to treat the kids who present with mental health problems that interfere with their educations and affect them and their families in very serious ways. And so given that we're already way behind many states that are providing those services, the potential impact of reducing federal oversight and federal funding is going to be devastating.
Refresh my memory, but didn't Jennifer Felix have to go off to the mainland at some point?
She did. Jennifer Felix was one of the first kids in 1989, well before the consent decree litigation. She went to Texas. She was the first child, I think, that I know of from Hawaii who was ordered by a judge to be placed in a residential placement in Texas, in her case. And she was there for a little less than 2 years, and they did a terrific job, and she was ready to come back. And at that point, they really couldn't provide a facility for her. They didn't have anything. She couldn't go back to Maui, and they eventually enrolled her in a house here where she was staying and going to Waipahu High School, And one day, after, despite the fact we put in staffing and alarms and so forth and so on, one day she wandered away and she was assaulted in the community. So that entire situation blew up. And ever since then, she struggled, and that's why we brought her as the named plaintiff in the litigation that ensued in 1993, because at that point in time, after having been stabilized and received a terrific program on the mainland, when she came back, there was nothing for her here.
And how is she doing today? I'm
in touch with her family on a regular basis. She has ups and downs. She's had a lot of physical problems. She's had back problems and other physical issues. But she lives in a house by herself with aids that are provided to her. And for the most part, she's actually got a pretty meaningful and productive life. She's now, I think she's in her 50s.
I guess you just then think about all the other Jennifer Felix cases that have yet to come.
Constantly. And there are many, many. I think we're serving somewhere between 16,000 and 18,000 kids at this point who are entitled to receive special education and mental health services. And, many of those kids are languishing. And when they don't receive the services they're entitled to, they're often entitled to have an extension until the end of their 22nd year. We don't have facilities for those kids who are that age. I was just on the phone this morning with a child who's very severely disabled, and he has to be moved from the house that he's in because he's getting too old to be taken care of in that house. So he's got to go to some other place. And those kinds of changes for kids, those transitions, are particularly difficult for kids with disabilities.
So you don't see this transfer from the U.S. DOE to Department of Health and Human Services as an efficient, smart move?
Well, more than that, I certainly agree with that, but I see it as a very callous and uncaring move. There is no way that the people who run that department are going to be professionally invested in providing help to kids. It's just not going to happen. And, when I see some of the things that they say and do and the attitudes that they project in terms of how they view their jobs and their opportunities, I think it's going to be devastating, and I'm very concerned.
That was Eric Seitz, a Honolulu attorney who sued the Hawaii Departments of Health and Education some 32 years ago. Several protesters who attended the Hands Off Hawaii march this past weekend cited Trump's efforts to close the U.S. Department of Education as a top concern.
Support for HPR comes from the Big Island Chocolate Festival fundraising gala this Saturday at the Waikoloa Beach Marriott, with over 15 tasting booths, live music, dancing, and more. Tickets at BigIslandChocolateFestival.com.
Our next segment looks at a story by Honolulu Civil Beats data journalist Matthew Leonard. It's a follow-up to a story about a helicopter crash that killed three people when it went down in a Kailua neighborhood in 2019. Good morning, Matthew.
Hey, morning, Catherine.
Yes, so you did a deep dive on this, and it started with the open records request, right? You filed for a Freedom of Information Act.
Right. Yeah. So I was really trying to close the loop on this. I mean, listeners will remember this was a spectacular, terrible tragedy, mid-air breakup of a helicopter over a suburban street in Kailua, three people dead, lots of allegations were raised, following that, and then there were two other fatal accidents that same year in June and December. So it was really a very dark period for general aviation. So fast forward to January, and there's a call for an investigation into all of these issues alleged to be taking place at the Honolulu FAA's field office, the flight standards district office there. And this got all the way to the U.S. Senate Commerce Committee, who recommended it should be investigated by the Office of the Inspector General at the Department of Transportation. So, kind of high-stakes stuff. A Freedom of Information request reveals that never happened. So all of these allegations were raised that there was there was misconduct amongst managers at the FAA. Nothing happens for 2 years. And then our record request shows that then in February 2022, 2 years after it had been requested, the investigation is kicked back to the FAA itself, so effectively enabling the agency to investigate allegations against it. So that's kind of what the story gets into.
Yeah, and the headline is that the pilot in this helicopter crash wasn't properly certified.
Right. So he had been certified to fly in Hawaii. He'd only been on island for 2 weeks prior to the accident. He was certified by his own boss, the owner of No Victor Aviation. It turns out that she had been improperly granted authority to approve him to fly in Hawaiian airspace. So people have this thing called check airman authority, and that means you're a senior pilot or a senior examiner, and you can assess a pilot and say, hey, this pilot is adequately equipped and trained and, you know, competent to fly in Hawaiian airspace. This kid, when I say kid, 28-year-old man, had flown in New Mexico, but had only flown that route with passengers 3 days before the accident. So it just raises questions about this whole chain of enforcement where there was an improper authority given to the owner of the company. She then gets this guy the authority to fly, and then the fourth day he's flying, they have this fatal crash. And so it really just raises all of these questions about the effectiveness. And the FAA has admitted this in a civil lawsuit that was settled last June with the family of one of the passengers who died. So the FAA has paid out money and admitted that it had made these mistakes in granting this authority. So really the story is just trying to close the loop, because it's been 5 years, and our frustration, or mine, was what has happened to this investigation? What did they find, and who's been held accountable? The answer is no one has been held accountable, because there was no enforcement action taken against the company, and there was no, as far as I've been able to determine, any serious disciplinary action taken against any FAA employee at the Honolulu District Office.
And, you know, members of our Hawaii delegation, you know, have raised questions about our air safety here, because there's a lot of pressure, right, with this industry for yep. tours like this. And we just want to make sure we're safe in the air. Or if you're in your own home, you don't expect a helicopter to come crashing down in the street in front of your house.
Right. Sure. And Ed Case had not seen the report until Civil B provided it to him. He made some very strongly worded comments, basically casting some very real doubts over the rigor and effectiveness of the FAA's own internal investigation. And he's essentially saying that it didn't really address the core issues that were raised by the allegations that, you know, were first came to public attention thanks to an FAA whistleblower in December of 2019.
All right. Well, it certainly makes for interesting reading. But thank you so much, Matthew, for this report.
No worries, Catherine. Thank you.
We have been hearing from Honolulu Civil Beat's Matthew Leonard. You can read his story over at civilbeat.org.
Support for HPR comes from the Honolulu Museum of Art with Homa Nights, open until 9 p.m. Fridays for art experiences, live music, film, and dining. HonoluluMuseum.org.
Hi, my name is JD. I'm a local food systems advocate and a proud member of Hawaii Public Radio. I especially enjoy shows like The Conversation and Bite Marks Cafe, because they always have interesting and influential people talking about their various areas of expertise, and I find it comforting to know that we have people working on many different social issues in Hawaii.
Become a member today at hawaiipublicradio.org.
You're tuned to HPR One. Day 7 of our spring membership drive continues on The Conversation. I'm Catherine Cruz. A new short film at the Maui Ocean Center showcases the first humpback whales to return to Lahaina after the 2023 wildfires. Photographer and Maui resident Daniel Sullivan is the creator of the film, titled Kohola, the Hawaiian word for whales. He has collected a decade's worth of images and sound recordings to showcase the majestic giants as symbols of healing and hope. Sullivan spoke with The Conversation's Lillian Song about the film.
I've been photographing the humpback whales on Maui for 10 years at least, and I've always been drawn to humpback whales. They're amazing creatures, and For this project, I was photographing the recovery in Lahaina after the fires. And I remember noticing the first whales to return several months after the fire. And it was just this sign of normalcy in such a world that had been torn apart for us. And in Hawaiian culture, whales have always been a sign of hope and light. And in the Kumalipo and the creation chant, they're a symbol of light in a time of darkness. So for me, that was such a beautiful symbol in a time that we needed a sign of hope. So I started documenting the first mothers and calves returning to Lahaina after the fires. And it became a project, a story that needed to be told for me. A lot of my photography has traditionally been about connection and storytelling. And this was my first venture into putting a whole film together. And so I started combining the story that I was telling through the recovery in Lahaina and the community in Lahaina and the story of these whales coming back and this sign of hope for our island. So that's how the story came about. And yeah, that's basically it.
I can only imagine the wealth of material you're working with. Everything is so visually stunning. The images there, and it's so sonically rich. What lessons were you learning from these majestic creatures?
I mean, I think one of the most fascinating things for me is how little we actually know. I mean, you know, we're just touching the beginning of understanding their songs. You know, all these humpbacks migrate to our islands every year from Alaska, and they're all singing the same song every year. And that song changes every year. And I've been recording these songs for over a decade with underwater microphones. And so I started putting all those songs together as a soundtrack for the film. And, you know, there's a whole mystery to them. And there's such a beautiful sense of altruism to whales and compassion. And they're just really gentle creatures. And the closer you are to them and the more you spend time with them, the more you can't help but be affected by their energy. So for me, working on this project, that was a really fantastic part of it, being able to add the sonic elements and then add the visuals and then put it to all together as a film.
Mm. Sounds like you are wearing a lot of hats. And do you actually have a team that you can soundboard with as you go through this project?
Yeah, no, because this was my first film, and I'd always been intimidated by all of the prospects of making a film, because I'm traditionally just a still photographer. And because I wanted to make this so badly, I actually taught myself how to do the sound editing, how to do the video color grading. I did the narration. So it was really a one-man band for this entire project, and it was just so I could get it done and create this film to be able to share it.
I know you as a photojournalist, a photographer, your image is always just so breathtaking. So into the film, now we're talking moving images, right? You are really imparting those themes of hope, hopefulness. I'm seeing the beauty, the light of the majesty of the whales, the humpback whales, and these pods. Also just being out in the beauty that is home to you, which is Maui. What are those takeaways you hope that an audience member will leave with?
Good question. So for me, because my work has always been about storytelling, I hope that when people come away from the film, they're left with just the importance of the humpback whales to our islands, to our culture. I think that it's so important to protect the environment and protect these creatures. I mean, if you look back on the history of whaling in Hawaii, you know, they were almost completely decimated in the 1800s. And their story has been an amazing one. It's one of the real stories of hope And I would say, if anything, I would like to think that you come away with a sense of hope. Look at the recovery of humpback whales in Hawaii and how they had been hunted to near extinction in the mid-1800s. And since the environmental acts of preserving whales now, their numbers are up to around 27,000 for our migratory group here in Hawaii. So just that alone is a sign of hope at a time when we need some hope, you know, everybody needs some hope. So for me, that would be the main takeaway.
Right. And I really appreciate this opportunity that I got to watch your film, but how can our listeners see your short film, Kohola?
So I'm excited to have it showing at the Maui Ocean Center Sphere, which is this amazing venue that we have here on the island. And it's going to be playing every Tuesday throughout the month of April. Every Tuesday evening at 5:30 p.m., we have a Q&A before the film. And yeah, it's a wonderful venue. So you can register online, you can RSVP. And we have a link which is on all of my social media. It's on my Instagram, Daniel Sullivan Photography, and on my Facebook. It's the link in my bio. And it's a free film. So if you would like to RSVP, please do. And then the Maui Ocean Center will also be having the link on their website. But it's our RSVP only. And because it's a free show, the previous two showings have sold out in about an hour. We are just putting it up today. So please go and take a look. But if you just go to Daniel Sullivan Photography on Instagram or Facebook, you can register there.
Sweet. That's really good to know. But that also means that's only on Maui. What are your plans going forward? So others, you know, neighbor islands, the rest of the world can be in a theater setting to see your film.
Well, right now I've applied to a number of film festivals all over the world. And this is the first time I've ever done that. So that's a really exciting process. And then I'll find out, you know, which film festivals I get accepted in, hopefully. And then also I'm talking to a couple of airlines, which I can't talk too much about right now, but about it being an in-flight film for flights coming into Hawaii, which I'd be really excited about.
Exciting. That's really like something to look forward to. So all your heart, your love for your home, for your community and these wonderful gentle giants of the ocean that you've been observing for the past decade. It's all coming to fruition in this film. So that's wonderful.
Thank you. Yeah, no, it's been a wonderful process. And for me, it was really special to try to share a story of hope that came out of all the devastation we had on our island. And this felt like the best way to do that. This has been an amazing project. And it's been a wonderful way to share the story of our island and our connection to the humpbacks here, and also how important they are to Maui and our story. So it's been a wonderful privilege to be able to work on this project and to be able to share it with the community here.
We've been hearing from photojournalist Daniel Sullivan and HPR's Lillian Song. The documentary short, Kohola, highlights humpback whale migration and the return of the first whales after the Maui wildfires. Today's screening begins at 6 p.m. at the Maui Ocean Center Sphere. We'll have links to learn more at hawaiipublicradio.org. And that is it for us today.